or my parents or my grandparents. Hell, it wasn't even my great-grandparents. Isn't there a statute of limitations on the sins of the father? Yes, said Margaret coldly. Even to the seventh generation. You are still responsible for the things they did to our family, and as they can't pay for them, you will. This time, when she slapped me, she was a lot less gentle about it, and she hadn't been pulling her punches the first time. A thin trickle of blood ran down from my nose, pooling along the top of my lip. I couldn't wipe it away, and so I simply sat there, glaring helplessly. "You're going to tell us everything," she spat. "How many of you there are, where we can find you, what your defenses are like. Everything. And then, when your blasted family is safely in our custody, we can discuss whether or not you should be held accountable for what our ancestors have done." "You need a hug," I said. "Or maybe therapy. Or maybe..."
"I know. You need to be kicked in the throat."
"How about you unchain me, and I'll hug you before I kick you in the throat." "You're a violent little thing, aren't you?" she asked. "Peter told me how shamefully you treated him. I honestly expected more ladylike behavior from you." As she spoke, I realized that even when she was slapping me, she'd been careful to keep most of her body at an angle that would be virtually impossible for me to kick. She was smart. She learned from the mistakes of others. That just meant that I couldn't give her time to take notes when the time came for her to make her own mistakes. "What can I say?" I asked. "Some of us grow up in the care of global terrorist organizations. Others aren't so lucky." For a moment, Margaret actually looked sorry for me. I itched to slap that expression right off her smug little face. "We're not terrorists. We're the good guys. And now, it's time for you to start earning that redemption." She stepped away from me. "Gentlemen, she's ready. We can begin the interrogation." The Covenant's definition of interrogation wasn't nice. It wasn't gentle. It also wasn't going to leave any scars, so I suppose I ought to thank them for that. Although it's hard to thank anyone who thinks that, say, beating the bottoms of my feet with a wooden baton is a sociable thing to do. They weren't interested in my long-term dance career. They weren't even interested in my being able to walk normally the next day. What they wanted was information, and they were more than happy to hurt me if it would help them get it. As I had suspected, Robert was the most efficient of the three. Margaret was happy to help Peter hold me down, and Peter grinned disturbingly the whole time. But it was Robert who kept producing common household tools from his little box. He looked disappointed every time he had to get a new one, like I was letting them down by refusing to break. "You could end this now, you know," he said, pulling what looked like a blood pressure cuff out of the box. "All you need to do is tell us your name. That's all I'm looking for today, is your name. We know your surname is Price. Why not buy yourself a bit of rest and tell us what your first name is?" "Go to hell," I said. "I'm afraid you're going to beat me there," he said. Margaret took the blood pressure cuff, fastening it tight around my upper arm. I tried to squirm away. Robert raised a finger. "This will hurt less if you hold still." "Why the hell would I start believing that now?" I demanded. "Because I might be telling the truth, and wouldn't it be wonderful if I were?" I didn't say anything. I just glared mutely, willing him to fall down dead. Maybe that would have worked if I'd been Sarah and he hadn't been wearing an anti-telepathy charm and... Oh, right, if we lived in a comic book universe where the rules said that the bad people would be punished and the good people would always come out on top. Too bad we didn't live in that kind of world. Too bad we never had. And then the cuff around my arm began to expand, and the needles I hadn't previously been able to feel began piercing my skin. After that, I forgot about everything but screaming for a little while.
"What's your name, love?" asked Peter.
I screamed.
"Just tell us your name, and this can all be over for now. What's your name, love?"
I screamed. The more they inflated the cuff, the more the needles dug into my arm. The fact that it was designed to let air slowly out again meant that I never achieved equilibrium. The cuff would inflate, the needles would dig in, the cuff would deflate, the needles would shift positions, and then it would start all over again. It was a new, exciting way of hurting someone, and I wanted nothing to do with it.
"What's your name, love?" asked Peter.
I screamed, and kept screaming, until the sound ran out and I slumped, practically boneless, in the chair. Robert stopped inflating the cuff, letting it collapse with a soft hissing sound. Then he leaned in, wrapped his hand around the now deflated cuff, and squeezed. Somehow, I found it in myself to scream one last time, wailing like someone's family banshee. Robert kept squeezing, grinding his hand against the cuff so that the needles danced inside my flesh. His expression was sad, almost disappointed, like he hadn't wanted any of this to happen.
"What's your name?"
he asked, almost in a whisper.
Verity, I replied. Verity Price.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Verity Price," he said, and took his hand away.
The needles were still there, but the sudden reduction in pressure was such a blessing that I started to sob.
"Take it off. We have what we need for now."
"How is that what we need?" Margaret asked. Robert smiled.
"Verity's seen the light. She'll be willing to help us now, won't you?"
I couldn't say anything. I could only sob, and keep sobbing, as they gathered their things and left my tiny artificial prison. This time, they remembered to turn off the lights on their way out, and I was left alone again. Well, almost alone. The pain was still there, and was more than happy to be my companion in the dark. Professional dancers learn to work through pain. It's a part of the job. We dance on sprained ankles. We dance with broken ribs. We dance on blisters and bunions and broken toes. We are expected to be beautiful machines, capable of holding our form no matter what injuries we're hiding. All my training told me that I should be able to compartmentalize the pain. And so as soon as I was alone, and as soon as I stopped crying, I began to do exactly that. First up was an assessment of my injuries. The puncture marks in my right arm were probably the worst. They were still bleeding, and I couldn't move my arm enough to tell whether there were tears in the muscle. For the moment, I had to assume that they were all superficial, and that I'd be able to climb if I needed to. Anything else was unthinkable. My feet were in worse shape. I didn't think any bones were broken, but both soles were badly swollen and probably just as badly bruised. I wasn't going to be running anywhere anytime soon. I'd just need to find another way. Apart from that, all I had was a split lip, a bloody nose, some abrasions on my scalp where the hair pulling had gotten overly enthusiastic, and some extremely sore fingernails. They hadn't pulled any of my nails off, which was a small mercy, given how enthusiastic they'd been about driving slivers of bamboo underneath them. My whole life, I'd been hearing about how torture doesn't work. Torture is never the answer. Well, apparently our cousins at the Covenant never got that particular lesson. They thought torture worked just fine. I took a breath, held it until my lungs ached, and breathed slowly out. I could function. I was hurt, but not too badly, and I could function. That was a good thing, because I needed to get away the second I had the opportunity to do so. These people were willing and eager to hurt me in the name of their cause, and when they started asking for information more sensitive than my name, They'd probably be more than happy to move on to more advanced methods of extracting answers. I liked my fingers and my toes. I wanted them all to stay attached to my body. And I could no longer be sure I wouldn't give them what they asked for when the cutting started. I don't know how long I sat there in the dark, just breathing, waiting for the throbbing in my feet and arm to die down. When the door finally opened, I didn't twitch, even though the light burned my eyes. I just stayed in the same position, chin down, slumped as far over as the chains allowed.
"Not so mouthy now, are you?" asked a voice.
Peter Brandt. I allowed myself a brief moment of satisfaction. Of all three, he was the one I'd been hoping would come to check on me. Margaret had a holy crusade. Robert had a job to do. And Peter? Peter had a grudge.
"Please," I whispered.
"Please? Please what, love? Please mercy? You didn't show much mercy when you thought you had me. Why should we show any mercy to you now?"
Peter crossed the room to my chair. My leg twitched with the urge to be reintroduced to his balls at speed. I forced myself to keep still.
"There's not any mercy here for the likes of you. We're going to beat the devil right out of you."
"Please," I whispered again. "I need to use the bathroom. I don't want to."
I started crying again. It wasn't hard. All I had to do was press my feet a little harder against the floor, and the tears came practically on their own. Claiming to need the bathroom was an old trick, which meant it had a pretty high chance of failure. But you never succeeded if you don't try, as my dad always says, and it became an old trick because it worked so often. Most people don't want to deal with prisoners who come pre-soiled. Tears always helped with that sort of thing. Being tiny and blonde means that most people are looking for excuses to underestimate me, and Peter was from the Covenant. He had to consider me inferior, or he'd be admitting that the Covenant might not have the best training program out there.
"What's to stop you pulling a fast one and trying to get away from me, hm?"
He was smarter than I'd expected. "Damn." I sniffled and said,
"My feet hurt so bad I'm not even sure I can walk. How am I supposed to pull a fast one when I can't even walk?"
"What's in it for me?"
I almost dropped my subservient posture in favor of taking another shot at his groin. I managed to suppress the rage, barely, and whispered,
"Anything you want."
Hopefully, if I couldn't escape, his anything wouldn't be anything that forced me to kill him any more than I was already planning to. Peter hesitated. Then finally, he made up his mind.
"Stay there," he said,
and laughed as he walked out of the room.
Oh, I was definitely going to kill that man when I got the opportunity, or at least hurt him a lot.
I stayed in my half-hunched position, listening intently to the noises coming from outside my little room. First came the clinking of metal, and then the soft sound of a hasp being turned. He was undoing my chains. My wrists and ankle were still cuffed, but the chains themselves were no longer attached to whatever was outside the walls. Peter stepped back into the room a moment later.
"All right, love. Let's get you out of here."
"But how?" I whispered, raising my head. "I can't. I'm still..."
"I'm the man with the solution to your problem."
Peter held up a key, grinning. I grinned back.
"Awesome." "What?"
His grin faltered, replaced by confusion.
"Don't you get any ideas now? You're still..."
"Chained?"
"Yeah, I know,"
I said, and lunged. The chains had approximately a foot of give when they were attached to their anchor. If the false room was at floor level, which it was, because none of my captors had stepped up to enter, meant that the anchor had to be a minimum of a foot from the opening. I had at least 2 feet to play with, and I was going to play. To my surprise, my estimates had been off, a lot, and in the direction that worked for me rather than against me. I had 4 feet of slack to play with. The chain was still unspooling when my elbow hit Peter in the chin, followed less than a second later by my knee slamming into his stomach. I wasn't kidding about how difficult it would be for me to walk on my bruised-up soles, but what I hadn't mentioned was that they'd been focusing on my instep, not the balls of my feet. As a dancer, the balls of my feet are where I live. Peter went down like a sack of arrogant Irish potatoes, and I finished the job by slamming my balled-up, manacle-weighted fists into the back of his head. There was a risk I could kill him. That's always a risk with blows to the head. And somehow, I couldn't find it in me to care very much. He'd been willing to do a lot worse than killing me. The key was on the floor only inches from his hand. I grabbed it, unlocking the manacles on my wrists and ankle, and shoved it into the pocket of my bathrobe. Then I grabbed his belt, feeling frantically around until I found what I was looking for. The hilt of a knife. "Thank God," I muttered. I took the knife and his shoelaces. Then I turned, and I was out the door. The false room where I'd been held was set squarely in the middle of a large warehouse that had clearly been used for storage before it was converted into a temporary Covenant base. Old boxes still lined the walls, and there were hooks hanging from the ceiling. They looked disturbingly like giant meat hooks. I paused only long enough to be sure that neither of the remaining Covenant members were coming for me. Then I ran for the nearest wall, moving as fast as my aching body and battered feet allowed. It's amazing what a little adrenaline can do. I beat my own personal record for the 20-yard dash, reaching one of the stacks of boxes and ducking behind it a split second before I heard voices coming from the far end of the warehouse. "Talk," said Margaret, her irritation clear even at a distance.
"She simply won't. We don't work that way."
"You must stop regarding this woman as a member of your family," said Robert. "Her limits are not the same as yours."
"She's held up fairly well so far," said Margaret sourly. "Who's to say she won't hold out until we get her back to England?"
"If she does that, she's not our problem any more. I know you want to be the one who breaks her, but what matters is that she's broken, not who does it."
"Don't talk to me like I'm a child. I know what's at stake here."
They were getting closer. I pressed deeper into the shadows behind my concealing wall of boxes, trying to assess my options in the rapidly decreasing time I had available. The bathrobe was white, or mostly. The front was more blood-stained than it had been when they first put it on me. It would show up against the gloom like a beacon. Grimly, I untied the belt and slipped the terry cloth off my shoulders. Naked may not provide much protection from the elements, but a bathrobe never stopped a bullet. I needed to disappear more than I needed to preserve my feeble sense of modesty.
"Do you really?"
I tied Peter's shoelaces hastily around the hilt of his knife, creating a makeshift cord that would hopefully keep me from going unarmed. I needed both my hands free. I also needed the knife. This was the best compromise I could come up with on short notice. Once I was reasonably sure the knots would hold, I wrapped the cord around my right arm, using it to secure the knife to my bicep. The knots held.
"Of course I..."
Margaret's voice cut off mid-sentence, followed by a shout that was half-wordless exclamation, half-profanity. I heard her running toward the false room. Only one set of footsteps. Robert wasn't moving, and until he moved, neither was I.
"So, we lost you already, did we? Clever little thing. I'll have to arrange for additional containment measures when we get you back. And we will get you back, Verity Price. You can be certain of that."
He spoke like he knew that I could hear him. And maybe he did. If there was only one way into the warehouse, he'd have noticed me going by. That meant I had to be in the main room, somewhere. That didn't mean I had to make things easy for him. I slipped farther back behind the wall of boxes, hooked my fingers into the first available handhold, and started climbing. Most humans think flatly, It's not a criticism. Humanity evolved when monkeys left the trees, and, as a whole, we haven't been all that eager to go back. Most people rarely look much higher than their own line of sight. More importantly, most people stop climbing when they get out of elementary school. Robert might expect me to seek higher ground, but he wouldn't expect me to do it silently. And if there's one thing I've learned from years of free-running, it's how to ascend without making any noise. I stopped once I was 10 feet off the ground, moving sideways until I found a cleft between two boxes that I could wedge myself into without making myself visible. And then I waited. It wasn't a long wait.
"She's gone!" shouted Margaret.
"I gathered as much," said Robert. His voice was closer now. I didn't move.
"What happened?"
"I can't be sure. Peter's out cold, but it looks like she somehow convinced him to unchain her, and then walloped the holy hell out of him."
"She improvises well. We'll have to remember that."
Robert stepped suddenly around the edge of the wall of boxes, visible from my current position only as a flicker of motion in my peripheral vision. I froze in my hidey-hole, trying not to breathe.
"Her robe's here."
"She left her robe?" Margaret sounded incredulous. "What good did she expect that to do her?"
"It's white. White would stand out in here. It was the right choice, assuming she's not worried about running around naked."
Robert raised his voice, calling,
"You can come out. We understand why you ran away, and we're not angry, but there's no way you're getting out of here. You may as well make things easy on yourself, and stop hiding before we come looking for you."
Fighting back the snarky replies took an almost physical effort. I succeeded. The pounding ache in my feet helped. If they'd done this to me when they weren't angry, what would they do if they got me back? Robert sighed audibly.
"It's going to be like that, is it?"
He started walking away, presumably moving toward the boxes along the next wall.
"You know, I'd really hoped that we were making progress, Verity. I know we'll never be friends, but I wanted you to know that we respect your willpower."
I held perfectly still as I began counting down silently from 10. Sure enough, I had just reached 4. When a flicker of motion betrayed Margaret creeping cat-silent into the narrow space between the boxes and the wall. She was looking for me, and so I did the one thing that I could do. I didn't move. Without my bathrobe and in this degree of shadow, my hair and skin would look like they were all one color. I just hoped that it would be the color of the box that I was huddling against. I could climb. Climbing was mostly a matter of digging in with my toes and forcing my way past the pain, but I wasn't going to place bets on my being able to run any time soon.
"Where is she?"
Peter's voice blasted into the warehouse, loud and sudden enough that I nearly flinched. I managed to restrain myself, the large muscles in my thighs jumping frantically as I struggled not to panic.
"Where's that little Healy bitch? I'll strangle her with my bare hands!" "Your interest in doing things with your bare hands is how we lost her in the first place," snapped Robert.
His voice was a whip crack in the quiet of the warehouse. Margaret was still creeping along, moving like she thought there was no chance I'd have seen her. I pressed myself deeper into the crevice, barely allowing myself to breathe as I watched Margaret inch her way along. In the movies, this would be where I inevitably had to sneeze, triggering an exciting chase scene. In the movies, I wouldn't be stark-ass naked, and I'd have a machine gun or something, not a single stolen knife. I didn't sneeze, and below me, Margaret moved on by, still searching for my hiding space. When she looked up, the shadows, faithful to the last, made me look just like another part of the wall. God bless the limitations of the human eye. She passed out of my sight, her footsteps moving to join the others.
"She must be in the upstairs," said Robert.
That was news to me. I hadn't realized there was an upstairs.
"Well, let's go get her," snapped Margaret.
We need to get her back into custody, now.
I'm going to kill her, said Peter.
No, said Robert. You're not. We're going to enlighten her. I think you'll find that she enjoys that far less. The three of them moved off together. Their footsteps faded into silence until I finally heard a door close in the distance. I still stayed where I was for another 5 minutes, measuring the time by counting off the steps of a proper Viennese waltz in my head. Finally, I was satisfied that I was alone, and I allowed myself to unlock my shoulders, sagging into a sitting position on the box where I'd been standing. I was alone, naked, practically unarmed, and terrified. I might not have much time, but I had long enough. Bending forward to press my forehead against my knees, I closed my eyes and cried silently until the tears ran out. When I was sure that I was done leaking, I unfolded and stood, not bothering to wipe my cheeks. These assholes from the Covenant wanted to play? Oh, we'd play. And they'd lose.
Chapter 22.
Never forget that I loved you, and I did the best by you I could. You can forget everything else about me, but please, don't forget that. Enid Healy. Hiding from the Covenant of St. George in a warehouse somewhere in Manhattan. The first thing I needed to do was find a way out that didn't involve going past the Covenant. There's nothing dignified about racing naked across the rooftops of Manhattan. For one thing, without a bra, I was going to wind up in a world of pain, and that didn't even start to go into the situation with my feet. But that wasn't going to stop me. If I had an exit, I was going to take it. The trick was going to be finding that exit without coming out into the open. I carefully extracted myself from my position between the boxes and began climbing again. Higher ground helped my nerves. Margaret and the others wanted me alive, for the moment, and that meant they'd be reluctant to shoot me. It's never a good idea to shoot someone you're not intending to kill, no matter how good of a shot you think you are. That's something I learned from my grandmother, and she's the best shot I've ever known. Even when you're aiming for the hand, you'd best assume you're shooting to kill, was what she'd said, and she was right. Shooting to wound was only a few inches from missing your target entirely, and a different few inches from killing them. Assuming the Covenant had similar training, a big assumption, but I had to go with something, they'd try to use other means of getting me down. Besides, once I was high enough, they'd be even less likely to see me without my wanting to be seen, and there was something to be said for that. I didn't want them to take me alive. I didn't want to die either. That meant I needed to escape. The boxes were piled high enough that I could see the rafters overhead, but not so high that I could reach them. I couldn't even jump with any assurance that I'd hit my target, not with my feet in their current condition, and a misjudged landing could send the entire stack of boxes toppling. That wouldn't be exactly what I'd call subtle, and it would bring the Covenant rushing back to find me, instead of wasting more time searching the upstairs. I wish to hell I had some backup, I thought grimly, frowning at the unreachable rafters. That triggered a whole series of thoughts I'd been trying to avoid. Like, why couldn't I feel Sarah if we were still in Manhattan? I should have been able to tune in on her static, even if she was too far away to communicate telepathically. I wasn't wearing Margaret's anti-telepathy charm anymore. Hell, I wasn't wearing anything anymore. It wasn't likely that Sarah would have left town while I was unconscious. So where was she? If Sarah was unlikely to have left town, the Covenant was even less likely to have found her without me to lead them to her hiding place. She was a cuckoo. She was probably terrified by whatever feedback she picked up when Margaret knocked me out. That would have been enough to activate her automatic defenses, and once those were up, they'd never be able to catch her. That meant they were still blocking her telepathy somehow. It was the only explanation for her ongoing radio silence. There was no way they'd have been able to telepathically shield an entire warehouse. The resources required would have been massive, and it would have meant bringing in several witches, if not a witch, a sorcerer, and some variety of exorcist. So they had to be telepathically shielding me. I wasn't wearing anything. But that didn't mean I hadn't been forced to swallow anything. I put a hand on my stomach, feeling suddenly queasy. "Okay, Verity, settle down," I thought sternly. "Even if you ate it, it's not poisonous. They wanted to bring you back to the Covenant alive, and that means they're not going to have fed you any mercury-based charms." Oh, I hoped I was right about that. Sure, healing over because I'd been poisoned would be a dandy way to prevent myself from telling them any of the family secrets, but it wasn't exactly on the top of my to-do list for the day. It wasn't a guarantee of my silence either. The phrase, "Dead men tell no tales," doesn't hold that much water in my family. We know a lot of ghosts. My Aunt Mary died years before I was born, and no one, living or dead, has any idea how to shut her up. I took a deep breath, trying to calm myself down, and went back to looking for things that could help me get up into the rafters. The boxes weren't high enough, and I didn't want to start rearranging them. There was no telling how heavy they were, or how many of them were rotten on the inside. That left the hooks that hung from the ceiling. I looked at them, assessing the distance I would have to leap. If I could just grab hold before I fell, I could climb the chain to reach the rafters. Tetanus would be a risk, but hell, in my line of work, tetanus is always a risk. "Only die once," I muttered. That wasn't quite true either, and started climbing back down the boxes. It was a stupid plan. It was a potentially suicidal plan. It was the only plan I had, and so I intended to go for it. Never allow for the possibility that you might fail, and you'll succeed just because the universe is too embarrassed to admit that it painted you into a corner. My feet hurt worse than ever by the time I reached the floor. Every bend of my toes was agony, and putting my weight down on my heels was like standing on hot coals. Ballet helped with that. After years of point classes, where bleeding toes were considered a status symbol, a little bruising wasn't going to slow me down. I hit the ground running, a naked blonde streak heading as fast as I could for the false room that had been my prison, and would now hopefully be my salvation. As long as I didn't slow down, I could use the pain in my feet to motivate me. I was going to pay for that as soon as I stopped. The limits of the human body are something that I am intimately familiar with. But for the moment, adrenaline and inertia were both on my side. I assessed the pain as I ran, letting it serve as its own diagnostic engine. The bruising was as bad as I'd thought it would be, maybe a little worse, but that was all. It didn't feel like they'd actually managed to crack any of my metatarsals, which was a relief. Bruising was going to be a lot easier to work around than broken bones. I didn't slow down as I approached the side of the false room. Instead, I aimed myself for the doorway, leaping at the last moment to grab the top of the frame. I let my own momentum carry me into a forward jackknife, then whipped myself backward and flipped up onto the roof. I landed silently, my bare feet actually helping with the action. "If you wanted to keep me, you should have broken my fingers," I murmured. Then I straightened, turned, and started running again before my feet could fully realize that I had stopped. This time when I jumped, I launched myself into empty air. For a moment, I was flying, arms outstretched, like a Lady Godiva superheroine aiming for the sky. Then my hands hit the big metal hook dangling from the ceiling. I grabbed hold, clinging as tightly as I could while the force of my leap sent the whole chain swaying. The extra 10 feet of height I'd been able to gain from the false room had been enough to boost me to the necessary level. Thank God. If this hadn't worked, I probably would have wound up with a broken leg, and that would have been a lot harder to work around. The chain creaked as it swayed, but quietly. It was too heavy to get up any real momentum, and that was keeping the noise down, for the moment. "Gonna need a tetanus shot when all this is over," I muttered, and began climbing up the still-swaying chain, heading for the ceiling. It was time to get out of sight. The less said about my trip up the filthy, rusty, incredibly cold length of chain, the better. Except that the whole experience left me with a lot of respect for Antimony's trapeze classes. Not that she was usually into climbing chains. Ropes were more her thing. But my arms were aching by the time I reached the rafters, and my shoulders felt like they'd been scooped out and replaced with mashed potatoes. Once I was at the top of the chain, I had to actually pull myself onto the main support beam, another task that was easier said than done. It was bigger around than the span of my arms, a sort of old, solid construction that was supposed to outlive the city itself. I finally managed to hook my foot into the loop that secured the chain to the beam, scrabbling up the side of the wood and collapsing, face down, onto it. What were a few splinters in sensitive places after everything I'd already been through? Answer? Damn uncomfortable. I stayed where I was for longer than was probably a good idea, wincing as the feeling came slowly back into my arms. Once I was sure that I could move without sending myself plummeting to the floor, I sat up and looked around me. The beam where I was seated was covered in a thick layer of grime, cobwebs, and rat droppings. I was naked in the middle of a major health hazard. The filth was at least reassuring, confirming that no one else had been up here in years, if ever. The Covenant wasn't likely to start looking for me in the rafters until they got really desperate, and by that point, I would hopefully be long gone. There was less than 7 feet of space between me and the ceiling. If I stood on my tiptoes, I could have brushed my fingers against it, assuming I would have wanted to. The cobwebs were even worse up there, creating a hanging shroud of grime. The big beams, like the one I was starting to think of as mine, were spaced evenly down the length of the warehouse. Smaller beams connected them, creating almost a network of catwalks that someone without a fear of heights could use to traverse the building easily. Best of all, they connected to the windows that were set high into the walls. All I had to do was get there, get the windows open, and get out. Emboldened by what looked like the nearness of my escape, I stood. Only years of hard training and harder discipline kept me from screaming as I put my weight back on my bruised feet and promptly fell down again. I managed to grab the edge of the beam before I could roll off into space. I clung for dear life, curling into a ball and sobbing into the dirt. This moment had been coming since I escaped. I'd known it was coming, had seen and catalogued the signs. You can only keep running on a bruise for so long. Still, I had refused to believe that my body would betray me like this while I was still in danger. Like the idiot I sometimes was, I'd allowed myself to believe that I could just keep running and fall down when it was safe. It wasn't safe. It was a long damn way from safe. But I was still falling down. My tears turned the grime against my cheek into a horrible, foul-smelling mud that smeared on my face. I struggled into a sitting position and tried to wipe it away, but only succeeded in smearing it down my chin and all over my hand. That just made me cry more. I was dirty. I was alone. And I was hurt too badly to be doing this by myself. It was funny, really. I'd always known that I wasn't going to have a long and peaceful life. That sort of thing is reserved for people who think the monster under the bed is just a story, and who run away from the sound of screaming, not toward it. Somehow I'd always expected to die so fast that I wouldn't even realize it was happening. A broken neck, like my great-grandmother, or a swarm of Apraxis wasps, like my great-grandfather. Maybe even sucked into a portal to another dimension like Grandpa. But no. My choices had to be tortured to death by the Covenant or starved to death in the rafters of an old warehouse. Talk about a rock in a hard place. My tears gradually ran out, replaced by a hollow feeling in my chest. My parents would never know what happened to me. My mice wouldn't even be able to give a full accounting. I'd be one more branch lopped off the family tree, with nothing to show that I'd ever been alive. Well, almost nothing. I'd managed to sway a Covenant agent over to our side, and that was something we hadn't done for a couple of generations. Grandma Alice was the last one to accomplish it, and she'd used similar tactics, being cute and blonde and persistent. It was weird to think that she would probably outlive me. Unbidden, the image of my grandmother rose in my mind's eye, hair spiked with some unnameable goo from some equally unnameable hell thing that she'd just killed, a sour expression on her face.
"You call yourself a price girl? Get up. Fight. Don't you give up like this. That's something a Covenant trainee would do, and you're better than them."
When all else fails, talk to yourself. "My feet hurt," I informed her.
"I carried my father's dead body out of the woods when I was bleeding out from Apraxis stings," she countered. "If you can't walk, you crawl. Show me what you're made of, girl, or I'll start thinking you're a cuckoo left in place of my real granddaughter."
It wasn't really Grandma, but my imagination definitely talked like her.
"Yes, ma'am,"
I said, and shifted to my hands and knees. My imaginary grandmother smiled before she disappeared. I smiled back, and then I started crawling. The beam was rough and splintery in addition to everything else. I'd barely gone 5 feet before my knees were bleeding. I was going to need more than a tetanus shot when this was all over. Still, I was moving, and that was better than I'd been managing a few minutes before. Infection was something to worry about after everything else was taken care of, like the 3 Covenant agents who knew my name and face. I was going to have to kill them. I couldn't see any way around it. Maybe not right now. Right now, escape was a bit more of an immediate priority. But there was no way I could let them live. I'd never be safe again if they were out there. And if I wasn't safe, I couldn't go home. I might be able to go and hide with Grandma Baker in Ohio, but the rest of my family would be lost to me. The Covenant has taken too much away from us since the day that we decided we had to leave. I wasn't going to let them add me to the list. Maybe it was a flimsy justification for murder, but we've always argued that cryptids deserved equal treatment with humans, and I was raised to believe that a cryptid who represented a clear and present danger to another sapient species had to die. Predators don't get a free pass just because it's in their natures. The Covenant agents were predators. I was their prey. Fighting back didn't make me a bad person. It made me someone who was willing to practice what I preached, and treat them like any other dangerous creature. If they lived, I, and a lot of innocent cryptids, would die. So they had to die. End of story. The beam terminated where it met the wall, joining with the rest of the building's support structure. I stood again, gritting my teeth against the pain in my feet, and pressed my hands against the wall as I leaned sideways to examine the window. My heart sank as I realized that there were no latches, no hinges, no way to open it at all. The windows were made to let in light, not fresh air. It made sense. Who would be climbing up here to open them? I mean, besides a naked girl with bruised feet and a stolen knife, of course. I looked up to where the window frame met the ceiling. The Covenant was up there, searching for me. Somewhere above them. The roof was up there, too. I only had one shot at getting out of here, and that meant finding a way up, assuming I could manage it. That was a big assumption. I knew nothing about the warehouse where I was being kept, other than it had a large downstairs and a second floor. I paused, suddenly feeling like an absolute idiot. I knew nothing about the warehouse, except that it was a warehouse, and it was built before they had cheap and dependable elevator technology. That meant all the floors would need to be connected by some sort of hatch system to enable them to move things from one floor to another. I turned and started scanning the ceiling, looking for the telltale outlines of a removable panel. I found what I was looking for about halfway across the room. A square where the cobwebs didn't quite match the ones around them, maybe due to drafts blowing down through the ceiling/floor. More tellingly, That was one of the only patches not used to anchor anything at all, and there were no beams crossing in the space below it. That had to be one of the transportation hatches. Now the only challenge was getting to it. I could crawl and risk shredding my hands and knees further when I might still need them, or I could try to walk. Neither option seemed like it was a particularly good one, and so I went for the better of two evils. I would walk. Maybe that would make my feet go numb enough that I'd be able to escape without tripping. If it didn't work, well, I'd find another way. I took a deep breath, centering myself as I found my balance, and began walking slowly down the beam toward the hatch. Balance beam was a part of my earliest gymnastics classes. I always excelled, because I had no fear of falling. This was different. If I fell, there was nothing I could use to catch myself. No convenient handholds or ways to redirect my inertia. I walked slowly, all too aware of how much space stretched between me and the floor. I didn't look down. That would have been suicide. And all appearances to the contrary, I've never particularly wanted to make a splash when I died. Step by painful step, the hatch came closer. I was almost there, when a door slammed behind me and I froze. Only long practice at navigating rooftops and high places kept me from losing my balance.
"She not be there! There's no way she made it out of this building!"
The voice was Margaret's.
"You're right, and she's not going to get past us."
Robert, that was actually a good thing. Peter might be the one who'd been most willing to harass me, but he wasn't the planner of the bunch. If he was the one guarding the second floor, my odds had just improved.
"The front door is locked. The back door is locked. The basement has been sealed off for years. She's trapped." "I hate her."
There was a note in Margaret's voice that might have been grudging respect under different circumstances. Robert actually laughed.
"Not for nothing, but I bet she's not too fond of you either."
"Please don't look up. Please, please don't look up." I remained frozen on my beam, listening as they passed below me. I was filthy enough that I would probably blend into the ceiling by this point, but that didn't mean I needed to start tempting fate. I was so focused on keeping still that I was barely even breathing. Just keep going.
"Has there been any sign of DeLuca?"
Robert asked the question calmly, almost casually, like it was of no real importance.
"No, you were right. The little whore turned him traitor," snarled Margaret. "He's just as bad as she is." "Peace, Margaret. We'll catch him next and deliver them both to our superiors. He'll have a great deal of explaining to do."
The footsteps stopped almost directly below me. I forced myself not to move. In a way, my damaged feet were almost a blessing. If I hadn't been hurt, I would almost certainly have run.
"What is it?" asked Margaret suspiciously.
"I just don't understand how we could have lost her like this."
The footsteps didn't resume.
"There's no way out of this room. There's nowhere she could have run. But she's gone, all the same."
"It's impossible."
"Nothing's impossible," said Margaret.
"Apparently not," said Robert.
The footsteps started again. I waited until I heard a door slam on the far end of the room before relaxing enough to start breathing. I still counted silently to 100 before I peeked over the edge of the beam and found myself looking straight down into Robert Bullard's smiling face.
"Gotcha,"
he said. I straightened up and bolted for the hatch. Pain is a powerful motivator. So is panic. And when the panic is extreme enough, even pain can find itself set by the wayside. I forgot about the ache in my feet, the distance between me and the ground, and everything else in my hurry to reach the only chance I had of getting to the second floor. Below me, Robert was barking orders to Margaret,
who was no doubt figuring out her own route to the rafters. But since neither of them could fly, I still had a few minutes, and I was going to use them for all that I was worth. The beam didn't run directly under the hatch. That would have made it difficult to use, but it came close enough. I grabbed one of the vertical supports, leaning out as far as I could without losing my footing, and thrust my other hand into the cobwebs until it banged against the ceiling. The wood shifted slightly. I hit it again, harder, and felt it lift up. That was all I needed. When I hit it the third time, I twisted and rammed my fingers into the opening I had created before the hatch could fall back down. Then I let myself swing out, praying frantically to every god that I could think of as I scrabbled to get a grip with my other hand. Robert was still shouting, and I could hear a rattling, scraping sound that meant Margaret was probably halfway to the top of the chains by now. This was my only shot. I swung, grabbed for the narrow lip created by my fingers, and caught it. There was no time to dangle, no matter how stunned I was. I immediately began pulling myself upward, digging my nails into the wood and shoving as hard as I could to bump the hatch out of my way. It left splinters in my wrists and arms. I kept shoving. At this point, after everything, a few splinters were among the least of my worries. Cobwebs filled my mouth and eyes as I pushed the hatch open enough to get my head through. That was the last bit I needed to get sufficient leverage. I twisted around, grabbed the top of the hatch, and blindly pulled myself up into the second floor. The hatch slammed shut as soon as I pulled my feet loose. Choking and gasping, I clawed the cobwebs out of my eyes, trying to clear them. I was filthy. I was almost free. I was wiping the last of the cobwebs away when I heard the characteristic sound of a gun being cocked from directly behind me.
"Now isn't this a lovely little turn of events?" asked Peter Brandt. Shit.
Chapter 23.
Don't you worry about whether you failed your family. Family loves you, no matter what. Worry about whether you failed yourself. As long as the answer's no, then there's still a chance that everything else will be okay. Alice Healy. On the second floor of a warehouse somewhere in Manhattan, facing down a member of the Covenant of St. George. Peter's eyes traveled the length of my naked, filthy body, a smirk twisting up his lips. He lingered on my breasts for a moment, before flicking to my right bicep.
"Nice knife," he said.
"Yeah, I got it from a real asshole," I said. I didn't move. The gun, my gun, in his hand, told me that moving would be a bad idea.
"I have an idea. How about you look the other way while I jump out the nearest window?"
"I have an idea. How about I hold you here while my colleagues come up the stairs, and this time we make sure you don't get away."
His smirk turned dark around the edges, transitioning from an implied threat to a very real one.
"We want to take you home alive, but alive doesn't mean the same thing as intact, and you'll do a lot less running away without feet."
"Mutilation? Really? That's where you're going with this? I guess you people have stopped thinking of yourselves as the good guys."
I glanced around while I spoke, looking for something I could use as an escape route. There were windows on the wall, no more than 20 feet away. All I had to do was reach the windows, and I'd be scot-free. I made my decision in that moment. Maybe it wasn't the bravest decision I could have made, but it was the only one that made sense. If the Covenant took me back to Europe, I'd tell them everything, and I'd be lucky if they killed me when they were done. No matter what else happened, I couldn't leave this warehouse in their custody. I gathered what little strength I had left, saying one more silent prayer to whoever might be listening, and launched myself at Peter. He shouted something that I didn't quite make out, distracted as I was by the sound of the gun in his hand going off at the same time. A sharp pain punched through my stomach, sending duller shockwaves through the rest of me. I did my best to ignore it. I had more important things to worry about, like yanking the knife off my bicep cutting the shoelaces I'd been using to hold it there in the process, and jamming it into his shoulder as my momentum carried me into him. It wasn't a fatal wound, but it distracted him for a few precious seconds as he shouted, grabbing at the blade. I grabbed the sides of his head, breathing in to steady myself. He had time to give me one last, utterly stunned look before I was twisting hard to the left, turning his face away from me. There was a sharp snapping sound, and then he was collapsing, the dead weight of his body pulling him out of my hands. He took the knife down with him. I didn't try to retrieve it. I did scramble to grab my gun from his suddenly limp fingers, clamping one hand over the hole in my stomach to keep anything I needed from sliding out. It was a relatively small hole, thank God. If I'd been packing something with a larger caliber, I'd probably already be dead. As it was, the gut wound would definitely kill me if I didn't get it taken care of fast. But for the moment, it was definitely a distraction from the pain in my feet. Maybe I'd get really lucky, and shock would set in. Maybe not. Robert and Margaret must have heard the gunshot. I didn't know where the door was, or whether it even had a lock, so I didn't bother looking. I just turned and started half-running, half-limping toward the nearest window. I'd shoot it out if I had to. I'd do whatever it took to get out of this damn building. I'd die in the open air. If that was the closest I could get to a happy ending, then so be it. It was better than the alternative. The door banged open when I was still only halfway there, accompanied by the sound of running footsteps. "Freeze!" snarled Robert. I didn't freeze. What was the worst thing he could do, shoot me? I was losing blood fast, and the room was starting to go dark around the edges. One more gunshot wouldn't do anything but finish the job. As long as he couldn't take me alive, I won. "No," said Margaret. Her tone was different, much more anxious, and her accent was gone. She sounded American. "You freeze!"
"Margaret?"
Robert, on the other hand, sounded utterly puzzled. The footsteps stopped. Thank God.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm holding a gun to your head," said Margaret reasonably. No, not Margaret. It was Margaret's voice, but it wasn't Margaret speaking. The tones and accent were all wrong. "Verity, stop running. I don't know how long I can hold her."
I stopped running. I was so tired I could barely breathe. I still managed to turn and smile wanly at the scene behind me. Margaret Healy, the woman who'd lost her anti-telepathy charm, holding a gun against the temple of Robert Bullard.
"Hello, Sarah," I said.
Sarah contorted Margaret Healy's lips into a wan smile.
"You know, if you were bored, we could have gone to the ballet or something."
Servitors appeared from behind her, making their serpentine way into the room. Robert's eyes tracked them, his expression never changing.
"I'll keep that in mind for next time."
I raised the gun I'd reclaimed from Peter Brandt, aiming it squarely at Robert's chest. My hand was shaking so badly that I was afraid I'd miss my target, something I hadn't needed to worry about since elementary school. I removed my other hand from my stomach, using it to steady my elbow. Margaret, Sarah, gasped.
"Verity, you're hurt."
"Yeah, single gunshot wound to the abdomen. It hurts like a bitch, and I'm losing a lot of blood here, so if you're not the only member of the cavalry, this would be a great time to bring in reinforcements." The servitors were good for looking intimidating, but without a dragon there to give them orders, they weren't going to be good for much beyond that. I didn't know why she didn't have a dragon with her, and I didn't have time to worry about it. Spots were starting to appear around the edges of my vision.
"You're going to die here," said Robert.
He sounded surprisingly calm, considering the situation he was in.
"All of you. And you, witch, wherever you are. We'll find you. You'll pay for what you've done."
It took me a moment to realize that he was talking to Sarah. I actually laughed a little, snorting indelicately through my nose.
"Oh, dude, she's not a witch. Witches are way less dangerous."
"Cuckoo to you, too," said Margaret slash Sarah, digging the barrel of her gun a little deeper into Robert's temple.
Verity, can you walk?
I don't really know. Honesty is sometimes the best policy. I do know I wouldn't get very far if I tried.